This summer, I was in Las Vegas at James Randi's annual Amazing Meeting, where amazing people come and give presentations. Many of them do so because they've got a new book coming out or a new TV show or a new movie. One of those who talked this summer was a gentleman by the name of John Allen Paulos, who I had discovered back in 1988 when he wrote a book called Innumeracy, a wonderful book explaining how most Americans just don't get numbers and even simple arithmetic. It was an eye-opener for me, and after he spoke at TAM, I went up to him afterwards and told him so, and he told me he had a new book coming out this fall, and now it's out, and here he is. The book is called A Numerate Life. A mathematician explores the vagaries of life, his own and probably yours. John Allen Paulos, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks very much, Paul.
Nice to be here. Nice to have you here. You are a professor of math at Temple University, and you've written many books since Innumeracy, including Once Upon a Number and A Mathematician Plays the Stock Market, which was highly entertaining. But I'm curious, going back to 1988, have we gotten more numerate in this country? Are Americans doing better or worse with math?
It's hard to say. I mean, there are certain pockets of excellence in our schools, yet there are perhaps larger pockets of less than excellence, if I can put it kindly. And as far as numeracy in the general public, it's not clear that that has changed. I'm not quite sure how you would measure it, but nevertheless, people are still misled by simple arithmetic statements or probability statements that they don't understand. Most people's vocabulary in probability, for example, is very impoverished. It's limited to things like one in a million, 50-50, sure thing, and that's it. And as a result, advertisers, politicians can either intentionally or unintentionally mislead, or maybe they're misled themselves. People talk, can press some hot button issue about spending $50 million on some observatory somewhere, and people get all exercised and are kind of oblivious to multi-billion-dollar expenditures or $2 trillion wars. I mean, the numbers rhyme: million, billion, trillion, zillion. And yet people don't react proportionally.
Yeah, I wrote a column a few years ago after I saw a report from some transportation institute that said that people here in St. Louis lose an average of 44 hours a year in traffic delays, and under that it said that's more than one work week. And I thought, okay, but that's over the course of a year. And this perspective was not explained anywhere in the press release or in the news articles I saw about it, which is, if you work that out, 44 hours a year on the road, that's less than 1 hour a week, which means it's more like 10 minutes a day, which means you're losing 5 minutes in the morning and 5 minutes in the afternoon.
People rarely, deconstruct a number. I mean, if you do, you often get something that's absurd or not as alarmist as people putting the number out would have you believe.
Right. You call this book a quasi-memoir, a meta-memoir, an anti-memoir. What does that mean?
It's not a standard memoir. First of all, I'm very dubious of memoirs, biographies, and autobiographies. People just don't remember things. They lie. They slant. They rely on a few individuals. Their sense of statistics goes out the window if you read about some poll that had that interviewed three people. You wouldn't put much credence into the poll. Yet biographies often rely on two people or three people, and they could be biased. In fact, very, very commonly are. I mean, any story, a story of adultery, for example, if it's told from the quote-unquote cheating spouse's point of view, it'll be one thing. From the quote-unquote cheated upon spouse's, another. If it's told from the point of view of the outside lover, a third perspective point of view or from a neutral observer, assuming we know what that means, it's yet another. So I'm dubious of the whole notion, but nevertheless, this is a kind of memoir. I'll use kind of instead of quasi, meta, and so anti. In that I take events, vignettes from my own life, and use them as jumping-off points to describe mathematical notions that are relevant to the story of describing life stories, biographies of anybody.
But it seems like you're offering us a caveat, which is, I may be completely wrong about these things I remember.
Yeah, that's true, or at least partially. And, yeah, that's the price you pay to... and, you know, I mean, I think being uncertain, being dubious, being skeptical is necessary, fortunately or unfortunately. But, you know, people, even when they do their best to tell the truth, they don't, at least from some other people's perspective.
Okay. But, so with that perspective and with that caveat, let's delve into your memory here. When did you first say, and maybe you didn't say it, but you kind of realized it, I really like math?
I think I was in middle school, junior high school, as it was called in those faraway days. I was good at math, and I liked playing around with numbers. In fact, even from a young age, I remember counting my father's cigarettes. Unfortunately, he smoked ridiculous too much.
Mm-hmm.
With my grubby, sticky toddler fingers, I was pleased to discover each pack had 20 cigarettes, and my father probably didn't appreciate the peanut butter on his on his cigarettes, but nevertheless. So, and I was good at math, and I also kind of idolized the British philosopher Bertrand Russell, who was not only a philosopher, but a mathematician, or a logician. And kind of resonated with my youthful, skepticism or irreverent attitude towards everything. And that was another factor. But in college, I did major in mathematics, but I have a kind of anomalous background for a mathematician. I majored for a while in English. I majored. I switched to philosophy. To classics, actually, because I took Latin, 4 years of Latin in high school. I could speak Greek because of my grandparents. But I always came back to, I switched into physics for a while. I always came back to mathematics and got a PhD in mathematics.
Did you have somebody along the way who was a great teacher who inspired you?
Well, I had very good teachers, but actually the greatest inspiration, if you want to call it that, was a very horrible teacher in fifth grade who was kind of a martinet. He was the gym teacher and whatever, and he was, you know, a huge guy. And I was a little kid, and we were talking about sports one day. I think I was in about the fifth grade, and I volunteered that a pitcher for the Milwaukee Braves had an earned run average of 135. And he scoffed and said, "You can only have an earned run average of 27. Sit down," because he made people go to the front of the class. And my voice was quavering, my face was red, my hand was shaking. But I knew I was right. And anyway, later at the end of the season, the Milwaukee Journal published the statistics about all the players, and this particular pitcher had never pitched again. He got one man out and allowed 5 earned runs. and that does equate to an earned run average of 135. So I brought in the newspaper, which showed that that was indeed his earned run average, and he told me to sit down. But I knew I was right, and I knew he knew I was right. And even though I was small and shy, and he was big and blustery, it hit me that mathematics can confer power. It's you can be right, and no matter how big and powerful your adversary, if you want to think of the person that way, is, you can be right, and he or she can be wrong. So it's a strange sort of thing. Pedagogy is there's no universally best pedagogy. I mean, he was horrible, and I, as I said, had much better teachers later on. But nevertheless, I think it's not a bad way to induce people to study mathematics, as it may be more motivating than trying to figure out the height of a flagpole across the river.
And just for people who don't know how earned run averages work, it's a phrase baseball fans hear all the time, but a pitcher's earned run average is how many earned runs they give up on average per nine-inning game. And so if your pitcher only got one person out, out of three, that's one-third of an inning.
One-twenty-seventh of a game. And so 27 times 5 is 135.
Because you know a lot of people, when they heard you say 135, thought, oh, he means 1.35. He had a really low ERA of giving up more, just about 1 1/3 runs per inning. But no, this guy had an ERA of 135. 135.
Right, but in any case, the larger point, I mean, people always ask for the best curriculum, the best pedagogy. I'm in favor of the Common Core, but it's not a panacea, and it doesn't necessarily have to be universal, despite the word common. And I think an emphasis on cognitive understanding, on qualitative understanding, on looking at concepts and so on. Supplemented a bit by calculation manipulation, is the best way to go. I mean, stress understanding rather than computation. I mean, mathematics is as much computation as literature is typing. It's you need to type in order to write literature or novel writing. You need to compute, but it's more than that. Mathematics is a way of thinking. And it's kind of an imperialist discipline. You can apply it to almost anything. And in this book, I apply it to biography. Again, I take these events from my own life and then talk about mathematical notions, whether it be Kruskal's card trick or the butterfly effect of dynamics or statistical notions or, I kind of explain why, in some sense, we're all very strange. I mean, I start out with a little saying there are two kinds of people in the world, those who are very strange and those we don't know very well. And it kind of explicate that mathematically, looking at the fact that if you have a multidimensional hypercube or multidimensional ball, almost all the volume is along the outside, along the edge. So if you measure people by a complex of traits, almost everybody will be in along some of those traits near the edge, and they'll put them near the edge of the ball. So in that sense, we're all rather abnormal. Yeah. And I begin that by talking about people who weren't as they seemed. There was a very staid, banal, unimaginative guy I knew in graduate school. He always wore a suit and was very, quote-unquote, conventional, normal. And then I saw him once behind a building in downtown Madison, Wisconsin, and he had this a $10 bill, and somehow he had put it on the sidewalk, but shellacked it, so it was impossible to pick up. And he was around the corner waiting for people to walk by, spot the $10 bill, bend over to try to pick it up, and be unable to do so because it was under a heavy layer of shellac. And he would giggle uncontrollably, and it just seemed, what, this guy?
I want to go back just a moment to something you were talking about with the sphere and the volume of the sphere. You even say in your book that one day you were peeling a potato in your kitchen, and you quickly did the math on it and realized that in taking the peel off, you're removing half of the potato.
And again, that's a consequence of the most of the volume of any convex solid is in the edge. And I was also a very sloppy peeler, but and the potatoes weren't all that big.
Yeah, I was going to say, peel a little thinner.
Yeah, I know. But when I attempt to pin peel thinly, I tend to cut my thumbs and fingers. So I'd rather the potato suffer than my fingers.
I'd also like to go back to the students, if I could, and the teachers, and I'm curious what the impact of technology has been on your students or on education in general. Does having more technology in your pocket and on your desktop make math easier for people, or does it simply take away their need to learn all the basic rules of arithmetic?
I think in general it's a good thing. I mean, because it kind of forces people to concentrate on understanding, on qualitative aspect. I mean, in statistics classes, people used to figure out, correlation coefficients or regression matrices, and it's tedious and stultifying, and it doesn't really impart any great understanding. Or in elementary school, you have 100 long division problems to do, or middle school, you have 100 polynomials to factor, in high school or college, 100 functions to differentiate. I mean, that's mind-numbing. And with software that does it for you, I mean, you should do some so you really know what the software is doing, but there's no reason to do a lot of that. I mean, you want to figure out what it is, a derivative, let's say, in calculus, or an integral. An integral is a sum of a quantity which varies. And I know kids who went through, they take calculus, they get A's, and they have no idea what an integral is, but they can do all these techniques to find out what it is, integration by parts and partial fractions. And you say, well, yeah, but it's a sum of this thing. It's a sum. So, I mean, I think on the whole, it's a good thing because it makes it easier to emphasize understanding instead of computation. Computation should do a little bit so you know what the software is doing. But after that, what's the point then? There's software that shows you graphically what surfaces look like. And, in general, I'm a proponent of technology done right. I mean, not so you just plug into software and get a number and you don't know what it means, but done right, technology is a good thing. I'm also addicted to my smartphone, but that's probably more telling than anything.
Well, I think we all are to a certain extent. When I met you this summer, I mentioned that we met at the Amazing Meeting, which is an annual skeptics conference put on by the James Randi Educational Foundation. I'm curious if you count yourself as a skeptic in this way. When you hear a story, whether it's from a friend or in the newspaper or online or in a broadcast, newscast, do you, I don't want to say calculate the probability of it being true, but do you think about the various aspects of that story and think, that's unlikely?
Yeah, I do it all the time. Yeah, it's much of the time it just doesn't make sense. Or it may or may not make sense, but there isn't enough information given. And and people, I mean, being a mathematician, I tend to take statements literally. And the literal interpretation is very often incongruous with the kind of informal meaning that the speaker or writer intended to convey. So that disparity sometimes results in humor if you do take it literally. But, I do that all the time.
Well, then I wonder, the astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson has become famous in the last several years, not just for all of his outstanding work and his Cosmos series, but also because whenever a major movie comes out that has a major science component in it, he tweets about its inaccuracies, most famously for Titanic and Interstellar and recently for The Martian. Do you notice math errors in movies a lot?
Yeah, I do all the time, and I also tweet about them. In fact, Neil Tyson and I will engage in a so-called Twitter war this coming Friday, and he was gracious enough to give a very kind blurb to my book, my recent book, A Numerate Life. So, I do tweet about that and notice inconsistencies, but after a while, it, in a way, you know, It seems almost futile, since the people who understand kind of get bored, and the people who don't say, what's he talking about?
Yeah, but you've got to get it out of your system, don't you?
Yeah. I do. But in any case, yeah, I mean, I also read mathematical notions into stories or depictions that on the surface have nothing to do with mathematics. There's a section in my book on I talk about romantic crushes and relate it to Bayesian statistics. I mean, sometimes people's initial impression of somebody is extremely idealistic and romantic, and they're obsessed and besotted with them. And but after a while, the prior probabilities, to use a term from statistics, which are, you know, one thing, and then after a while, reality sets in, and Bayes' theorem, a result in statistics, tells you how to gradually revise your attitude in the light of more evidence and come up with more accurate assessments. And in mathematics, the assessment is very precise. But in a kind of qualitative sense, that's what we do when we kind of you have a crush on somebody, and it gradually dissipates as reality sets in and we readjust our thing.
Are you saying that love isn't chemistry, it's mathematics?
No, it's more chemistry than mathematics, but you can use mathematics, I think, to some extent to describe. You can use mathematics to describe a technique to choose the best possible partner for you, assuming you'll have X potential candidates to marry over the course of your life. What you can do is make a kind of simplistic assumption and go through them and either accept them or reject them. But once they're rejected, you can't come back to them. But the ideal strategy for picking the best potential spouse, best according to your personal ranking, is to reject the first 37% of them and then take the first one after that who's better in your estimation than all previous candidates. And it's ridiculously precise in everyday life, but it does support the idea that you shouldn't jump at the first person you're crazy about. But you shouldn't wait too long either. I mean, reject about a third, a little more, take the best one after that. I mean, you can't take that too literally, but it does support what I just said, this kind of informal understanding of not jumping too quick when you're 17 and not waiting until you're 52 either.
Have you tried to sell this algorithm to OkCupid?
No, I haven't. Happily, most people, including myself, did not use that technique, but as I said, mathematics is kind of imperialist, and you can apply it to almost anything.
Last thing I want to ask you about, John, is your role in the 2000 election, the famous Bush v. Gore election, full of hanging chads in Florida, etc. How did you get involved in that? What did you do?
As you just mentioned, the situation in Florida was very iffy. There were 6 million votes cast. There was hardly any difference between Bush and Gore. There were all kinds of outstanding ballots, hanging ballots, military ballots, butterfly ballots that were under dispute in different areas where they lost ballots and so on. Anyway, so I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times in which I said that the election apparatus in Florida is much too gross to register the fine differences. It's somewhat similar to, although being hyperbolic, somewhat similar to trying to measure bacteria with a yardstick. I mean, that would be absurd, and trying to measure these fine differences with this gross apparatus that has so many imponderables is, the margin of error was much greater than the margin of victory. In any case, the both sides were litigating, and then the Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court cited my op-ed, and he said, as mathematician John Alipoulos said, there's really no fact of the matter. And then he went on to say, well, because of that, I'm going against the rest of the court and stopping the manual recount. Which, in a 50-50 sort of way, would have resulted in Gore's winning. And then it went to the Supreme Court. But I felt bad I wasn't a fan, to put it very, very mildly, of George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And I was upset that, flattered in a way that he cited me, but upset that he used what I said as a reason to to stop the recount and ultimately, in a sense, lead to the election or perhaps selection of George Bush by the U.S. Supreme Court, not the plural.
Did you feel that the judge misinterpreted what you were saying?
He drew, I think, the wrong conclusion from it. Since it was so close, I think, they should have allowed the recount or, flipped a commemorative coin. actually, a moral weight should have gone to Gore, since in the rest of the country, he was ahead by 500,000 votes, not a couple hundred,
right,
which didn't really mean anything.
Right.
So, it's another case of unintended consequences or no good deed goes unpunished.
Yeah. I love the story, and I really enjoyed the book. It's called A Numerate Life. A mathematician explores the vagaries of life, his own, and probably yours. Mathematician John Allen Paulos, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you so much, Paul. I really enjoyed it.